I was starting to think of the sphere of possible things you could do while reading Marcus Aurelius. Anytime I read Marcus Aurelius, I fill in the blank.
we should do that on the podcast.
Things you could do while reading Marcus Aurelius.
Clip your toenails.
You could groom your facial hair like Worf does.
Sharpen your teeth.
You could sharpen your teeth, yes.
Read Marcus Aurelius, listen to Klingon opera, sharpen teeth. That is a banner night aboard the Defiant.
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 49 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me for the 49th time is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be discussing stoicism in Star Trek. Mike, are you feeling particularly unaffected by things around you today?
Well, yes, Zachary, I am feeling quite even-tempered today.
Well, I figure, Mike, if we're going to be talking about stoicism, we can't tell a whole lot of jokes on this episode of Metatrex.
Yeah, I did leave my bag of jokes behind, but I will say that laughter does do a heart good, so maybe we might pull out a joke or two, or three.
Well, Mike, before we dive into our topic, we should say that we have a new piece of feedback on Metatrex that we received by email from a listener named Vera.
Yeah, Zachary. Vera writes, "Hey, Mike and Zachary, I just started listening to your show, and I just wanted to say that I really love what you guys are doing. I went all the way back to start from episode one, and I'm hooked. I feel like I'm learning so much about philosophy and religion by listening to your show. It has definitely enhanced my enjoyment of Star Trek, which I didn't think was possible. I look forward to each new episode. Awesome show, guys. Keep up the good work. Vera." Zachary, what a thoughtful note by Vera, one of our listeners.
Absolutely. It's always really nice to get feedback from listeners. You know, I'm still kind of amazed that people want to listen to us talk about Star Trek and philosophy at all, much less 49 episodes. I sympathize a little bit for Vera going all the way back to episode one. I mean, that's 75 hours of us talking about Star Trek and philosophy. That's a lot of Zach and Mike. So she must really like listening to us. So that warms our hearts. And thank you, Vera, for the very nice feedback.
It does. It's so encouraging when we receive feedback like that. And I do want to say to our listeners out there, if you want to contact us, with feedback or suggestions for our show, there are several ways that you can do so. You can share your thoughts or anything that we discussed on this episode of Metatrex. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail if you want to go old school. You can just look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and leave us a voicemail there.
Old school is the new school, Zachary, and we might even play the voicemail right here on the podcast. You can also find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @TrekFM.
And if you want to interact with us on Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM. And one of the best ways to interact with us is via the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. It's a closed group for Trek FM listeners only, so just hit join, and someone will let you right in. And if you want to give us feedback or keep talking with us about Star Trek and philosophy there, that's a great place to interact with us.
And don't forget iTunes. We invite you to leave a rating and review of Metatrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and always suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, let's dive into our topic. This is an exciting topic about stoicism and Star Trek. And I think there are plenty of examples in Star Trek. And we're going to talk about some of the different races that are, you know, rather stoic. Some of the characters, perhaps, that you and I identify with as having traits that are somewhat stoic. So let's jump in.
Well, as we were thinking about what topic we could cover on this episode of MetaTrex, I was recently reading Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, a well-known Stoic philosopher and emperor of Rome. And for years, I'd been telling myself that my favorite character in all of Star Trek is Lieutenant Worf. And I mean that sincerely. I love everything about Worf. Worf is one of my favorite characters. I like how disaffected he is and how generally angry he is and how little he reveals himself, how much he keeps his cards close to his chest. He keeps everything bottled up. And once in a while, you get a display of emotion, but generally, he keeps himself pretty concealed and bottled up and even a little angry at the things around him that irk him or rub him the wrong way. And yet he still just plows forward through it all and does his job and is a good Starfleet officer. But Worf is one of my favorite characters. But I've been telling myself Worf is a Stoic. And as I thought about it before the show, I'm not sure that's actually accurate. So I thought what we could do is just start by giving a real quick, simple overview of what Stoicism is for people who haven't heard that term used in the context of philosophy before. I mean, we have the phrase Stoic. Like, if you're Stoic, you don't show your emotions. You keep yourself kind of bottled up. And so that's what made me think of the connection with Worf. But there are... Stoicism from a philosophical standpoint is actually kind of hard to define. It's not the most precisely defined philosophical movement. It started with a philosopher named Zeno of Citium. There's some Roman Stoics, Cicero and Seneca, the Greek philosopher Epictetus, and ultimately the Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius. Each of these Stoic philosophers has kind of a different variety of Stoicism, which we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about. I think that's a distraction from talking about Star Trek and philosophy. But these various Stoic philosophers do have a few things in common that are worth laying out here together. So one thing that they have in common is they all have the view that destructive emotions generally result in errors in judgment, that emotions are strong emotions or excessive emotion is harmful for your well-being, harmful for your decision-making, harmful for your inner peace, can cause harmful things in the world. And in my mind, Mike, that sounds a lot like Vulcans. You know, when I think, you know, hiding your emotions, Vulcans are the obvious connection. I think that when most people think about Star Trek and philosophy, the connection that immediately comes to mind for a lot of people is the Vulcans.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think within the Star Trek universe, I think the Vulcan race is by far the best example of Stoicism in Star Trek. You know, Stoics advocate the harmonization of a person's being with nature. And more importantly, Zachary, I think being able to accept your place in it. They believe that going against the natural established order in life would result in really nothing but pain. They don't worry about external events, things that are going on in the outside world that are largely beyond control, but rather, you know, to just maximize serenity. And I think about T'Pol going to her quarters to meditate. I think about Spock going to meditate. You know, this idea of meditating, maximizing your serenity, changing your perception of the things that are happening around you, and that's how they're able to maintain control of their emotions. They don't get too caught up in what's going on the outside. They rather accept their place in the natural order of things, and that's where they find serenity.
I think the thing, Mike, that's hard to convey about Stoicism to modern thinkers is that for the ancient Stoics, their Stoicism is grounded in this perception of the cosmos as a whole, the universe, or all of reality as a whole, as having a certain type of order. Certain things come into existence and they fall out of existence. You know, we're born and then we die. You know, various states of matter get organized into the things we see around us, and then they decay and they fall apart. And there's kind of a cosmic order to that of things coming and going. So this perception of things coming and going in the cosmos as a whole is supposed to provide some sort of comfort as people come and go in your life. You know, you form relationships with people and then they get old and they die. You get excited about something, a project, an accomplishment, and then time moves on and those things fall by the wayside. You can get so caught up in the ups and downs of the ebb and flow of the cosmos as a whole that you get overly attached to the things that will eventually disappoint you. So for Stoics, they try to remain kind of in the neutral part of the emotional,
rather,
of the emotional
curve.
Very placid. They don't want to get too excited or too disappointed by any of those life's ups and downs. But that's not purely out of practical reasons. It really is grounded in the sense of the cosmos as a whole has that sort of order to it. And when you're in harmony with that order, you recognize that the things around you are fleeting. You know, you are going to get old and die. The pleasures that you perceive now are going to end someday. The things that you love are going to go away. When there's a disappointment, by contrast, when there's a disappointment, things will get better eventually. So whichever side of the emotional curve you're on, they want to keep you kind of veering back the other direction, eventually headed towards something relatively neutral. So the Vulcans, I think, are a good model for Stoicism insofar as they remain neutral. I think the thing with Vulcans is they don't really go with the ebb and flow. They really push against it. They reject the emotion outright. I think with Stoics, it's not so much a rejection of emotion as it is a rejection of excess emotion. They're happy to enjoy pleasures when they come along. They definitely feel the suffering when it comes along, but you don't want to get overly happy, overly excited. You don't want to get overly disappointed, overly sad. You want to stay in the middle and realize that that's part of the ebb and flow of the cosmos.
Sure, sure. Yeah, placid often comes to mind when I think of Stoicism. Zachary, you mentioned Epictetus, a Stoic philosopher from ancient Greek, who said, make the best use of what's in your power and take the rest as it happens. And I think that is really a great summary of this idea of Stoicism. And it reminds me a lot of things like the Serenity Prayer that I know is very well known to many people, granting the grace to accept the things that, are outside of our change and the power to change, what we're able to change. And I think of the Apostle Paul from first century antiquity Christianity, who was a very Stoic, very, very Stoic individual in Christian history, who said that we should be anxious for nothing, but in everything with prayer and supplication, let a request be made known unto God. The idea was to maintain your emotional state and, therefore, kind of temper your reaction to the world around you.
I think there's a good side and a good side and a downside to Stoicism. The good side is it kind of arms you with the tools to prepare yourself for whatever comes your way, right? If you prepare yourself in advance for disappointments, then those disappointments won't be so bad. If you prepare yourself for the good times in life when they come, then they won't carry you away on a whim of emotion. The downside, I think, is it can lead you to being almost fatalist in terms of your station in life. In fact, Marcus Aurelius, who we talked about before, people called him the most Christian-minded, non-Christian, Roman emperor that there was, because he basically had that very thing to say, kind of whatever your station is life. If you're a centurion, be a good centurion. If you're an emperor, be a good Roman emperor. If you're a slave, be a good Roman slave, right? And that kind of acceptance of your station in life can be a reason not to try to do something to better yourself. So there can be kind of a self-defeating fatalism to Stoicism that I think is the dark underbelly of Stoicism. But there's some beautiful stuff in Marcus Aurelius. Like I'm thinking of passages like when he says that if you look around you in nature, thinking of humans as being more or less in harmony with nature, says if you look around nature, you can see the bees waking up every morning and toiling away, collecting their nectar and making honey, and all the creatures in the world that are out there do their best every single day to wake up and make some order out of the chaos around them. And so humans, we have this tendency to kind of be lazy and not want to get up and do our part. There's kind of this steadfastness to human labor that he thinks is a really good thing, that, it's our duty to kind of get up out of bed, do the work we have to do, diligently and dutifully and stoically. whatever your station in life is, there's a dutifulness to just getting up and going about your business and making the world the best you can make it given your little corner of the world. And, So there's very much this positive aspect of stoicism, of whatever your station in life is, you can do your little part to make it the best you can, regardless of your station in life, regardless of your circumstances, regardless of the disappointments you had yesterday, regardless of the, you know, things you're looking forward to tomorrow that may or may not come to fruition. You can get up out of bed, you can deal with the things as they come your way, and you can make, you know, your corner of the world the most orderly it can be, despite all of those ups and downs. So I think it's very comforting, because it's, you know, when there are hard times, you have to remind yourself there will be another day tomorrow, and it's not going to be so bad tomorrow. And I'm going to get up and I'm going to do something about it. And I'm going to treat it calm, cool, and collectively. I'm going to use my reason to reason my way out of it. And if I end up in an emergency tomorrow, I'm going to use my rational tools tomorrow, just like I did with whatever I had to deal with today. And that's, and I think Marcus Aurelius has a great faith in human reason, just being able to deal with the situations that come your way. If you get carried away on a string of emotions, what you're really doing is putting your rationality aside or in check, and not using your full rational faculties to deal with the situations that come your way. So part of rationality for Stoics is tempering your emotions so you can deal rationally with whatever situations come your way, no matter how extreme or how chaotic they seem.
I'm pretty sure Marcus Aurelius had pointed ears and green blood.
Well, Mike, it's funny you say that, because as I was thinking about the relationship between Stoicism and the various races and characters that we see in the Star Trek universe, it occurs to me that none of them is a really perfect fit for Stoicism. The Vulcans, I think, err a bit too much on the side of forcibly trying to keep their emotions in check and not going with the ebb and flow of... they're not very terribly self-aware, even frankly, of their own emotions. They're so much in denial that they're not very, very aware. And I think Stoics are generally more open to the fact that there will be pleasures and there will be pains. When enjoyment comes its way, when it comes your way, it's okay to enjoy it. They don't try to forcibly push away the emotions like Vulcans do. And I keep going back to Marcus Aurelius, because for me, Marcus Aurelius is like the most pragmatic Stoic philosopher. Whatever comes your way, he's got a little nugget of wisdom that will help guide your situation. But in the first couple of books of the Meditations, Marcus Aurelius thanks all of the people in his life that he's learned something from, his teachers and his relatives and ancestors and friends and whatnot. It's a quite a long list of people that he feels like he's learned something important from, just little nuggets of practical wisdom. And I don't have the exact passage in front of me, but one of the people that he thanks, he says he learned from that person to be generally amicable. When people come into your house, make them feel welcome, make them feel positive, amicable, you know, give them something nice to eat, you know, don't make them feel rejected. So again, it's generally a kind of a positive tone. And Vulcans aren't always good at this, right? Vulcans, if anything, I think maybe err a little bit too much on the side of having a negative front that they put forward, right? They're cold kind of on purpose. And Marcus Aurelius has a much warmer sense of what personal interaction should be like and what home life and family life should be like. To the point where I just don't get a Vulcan unemotional sense from it. I think generally there's a positive emotion or a positive connotation to the kind of amicability and friendliness that he sees in relationships with others and in his home life and in relationships with his family and whatnot. So I don't see pointed ears when I see Marcus Aurelius.
Well, let's just play Who Said This? Okay, we're going to play
Who Said This? Vulcans
I'm gonna put you on the spot. Okay. Yeah, you're always putting me on the spot, so I'm going to...
I didn't know I was signing up for a quiz show tonight, but okay.
All right, Johnny, let's play Who Said This?
I do have Google in front of me, just so you know.
Okay, Zachary, who said this? Are you ready?
I'm going to fail this. I don't know this.
Who said this? You have power over your mind, not outside events. Realize this and you will find strength. Who said this? Was it Marcus Aurelius or Sirach of Vulcan?
I think that's Sirach of Vulcan.
That is Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, man. Okay. See, I told you I was going to be terrible at this.
Okay. Who said this?
I didn't do the reading before I came to class, mine.
Who said this? Marcus Aurelius or Sirach of Vulcan? Very little is needed to make a happy life. It is all within yourself, in your way of thinking.
Marcus Aurelius.
That is Marcus Aurelius.
I recognize that.
All right. Who said this? Sirach of Vulcan or Marcus Aurelius? In accepting the inevitable, one finds peace.
Soraka Vulcan.
Soraka Vulcan.
That's too short of a quote. Marcus Aurelius has more words than that. So.
But my point is, and interestingly enough,
it was actually cool.
It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell. And that I think that's my point. And that's why I say Marcus Aurelius, I think, has pointed ears and green blood. And I say that in jest. But in reality, when I read Meditations, and I've got a copy in my library, and I love it. And as far as quotables for Stoic philosophy, I think Marcus Aurelius definitely has the corner on it. I don't know. I would say maybe Epictetus is probably a close second, but definitely Marcus Aurelius. But when I read Meditations, we've talked about this with Spinoza. You get this same feeling when you read Spinoza. You hear Spinoza in Spock's voice. I hear Marcus Aurelius in Spock's voice. It really is very applicable to the type of discipline I would say that Spock tried to apply to his life, the things that he kind of lived by. You know, when I think of Stoicism in Star Trek, I think of Spock. And surprisingly enough, the scene that always comes to my mind, I think, is that final scene in Wrath of Khan before he died. When he picks himself up from the wall, you know, Jim Kirk's walked in, he's planted himself in front of the glass, and Spock pulls himself up. He, you know, does a little Picard maneuver. He straightens his
tunic. He does do the Picard maneuver, doesn't he?
He does the Picard maneuver. How stoic is that, though? I mean, he has just taken a devastatingly lethal dose of radiation. He's dying.
Okay, well, on that note, in Star Trek III, the sequel to Star Trek II, Captain Kirk has a very similar experience. You know, his son David is killed by the Klingons. He falls down literally in the bridge. It's kind of an embarrassing scene for a starship captain, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not 10 seconds later, he picks himself back up and he's back in action to make the most of the situation. That's an incredibly stoic reaction, I think. But what's interesting there is, by contrast, Captain Kirk is okay feeling the emotion just for not very long, and he immediately finds, you know, rebalances himself, picks himself back up, and he's back in command of the ship again. But he does have to fall down, and I think Vulcans don't like to fall down as much.
I have to agree with you on that. But, you know, it just amazes me the way Spock is able to pick himself up. He straightens his tunic because, after all, he's a Starfleet officer, and he's, you know, he's going to go over there and he's going to face his captain and report in, you know, and his suffering, his pain, his weakness, the fact that he is breathing literally his last breaths, it matters not. He's going to do his duty because that's what he can control. He can't control the fact that he's dying, but he can do his duty to the very end and give his report to Kirk and make sure the ship was safe.
And while we're doing the highlights of the original series movies, in Star Trek VI, we get a very interesting discussion between Valeris and Spock, and where Spock tells Valeris that she has to have faith that the universe will unfold as it should. And that's famously an incredibly stoic sentiment. I mean, this is where we absolutely really see the cosmic perspective coming into play, that what gives Stoics their unflappability in the face of whatever comes their way is the fact that the universe is built this way. Whatever the universe throws at you, that's how the universe is supposed to unfold. So what business do you have beating your head against a wall, going against the grain, fighting the river or fighting the wind? This is just the ebb and flow of the universe. So it's just going to unfold as it should, and you can fight it or you can go with it. And if you're going with it, you shouldn't be upset by it.
Yeah, Epictetus said there's only one way to find happiness, and that is to cease worrying about things which are beyond the power of our own will. And what a Vulcan way of thinking. And it almost seems like a follow-up statement to Spock telling Valeris, we have to have faith that the world's going to unfold the way, you know, the way that it should. It really is a Vulcan way of thinking. And just like Vulcan logic requires, I think, years of dedication. It takes practice. It takes discipline in order to be able to look at life in that light. I think Stoicism is really the same way. And I think that's why many of the Stoic philosophers didn't just wake up one day and, you know, oh, I'm a Stoic. It was through years of discipline and learning. I mean, many of the philosophers that we've already mentioned really studied years under multiple, philosophical mentors, if you will, who really schooled and ingrained this philosophy in them. And it was a daily discipline and a practice for them, very much the same way I think Vulcan's discipline and practice in order to achieve Kolinar.
Well, while we're talking about Vulcans as Stoic, there's a scene in an episode of Voyager, Gravity, where that comes to mind. In that episode, we see a young Tuvok learning to control his emotions. As a young man, he's in love with a classmate of his, and he's being swept away on this torrent of emotions, passion, unrequited love, and his life has spiraled out of control. And there's a Vulcan master there who kind of gets him to recognize that his emotions have spiraled out of control, that they're controlling him, and he has lost his free will. He's lost his autonomy. He's lost his self-control. And even though Tuvok is claiming to this Vulcan master that this torrent of passion is actually liberating him from this Vulcan stoicism that he finds oppressive, the Vulcan master helps him see that it's actually the other way around, that it's those emotions that are oppressing him, that logic or the control of his emotions or tempering those emotions is what allows you to regain your autonomy and regain your sense of self-determination, to regain your control over your life. And I think all of us have probably experienced something like that, where we've been swept away in a torrent of emotions that are out of our control, and it's important to be able to temper those emotions back into a normal state. And what's interesting is that Vulcan master reveals that he doesn't reject his emotions outright. He does feel certain things, and Tuvok gets him to admit that, and he doesn't even shy away from that. This grand old Vulcan master doesn't say, I have no emotions. He says, I do have emotions. And isn't that surprising? You think that's surprising that I have emotions? Of course I have emotions. I recognize them, and I've learned to control them and temper them and not let them spiral my life out of control. But I think you're right. There's something of an education process in terms of learning to control your emotions responsibly from the Stoic standpoint. It's not something you can just do. And for Vulcans, their education process is part of that mental training. Their meditation process is part of that mental training. And I keep going back to Marcus Aurelius, because for me, he's the Stoic philosopher that really speaks to me. The others, I think, really don't so much. Marcus Aurelius, I find incredibly relatable on a very human, personal, practical level. And one of my favorite sections of the Meditations is when Marcus Aurelius is describing this kind of mental exercise he goes through to put things in perspective. He likes to dwell on or think about the various states of decay that things will be in. He thinks about the people he cares about, and then he pictures them in their grave, pictures them being cremated, as a way of saying, look, don't get too attached. These people are not going to be here forever. You can't get too attached to them. Think about all the pleasures in life and what it's like and what they really entail. He's really graphic. He says, think about things like sexual pleasure. Picture your organs just being, flaps of skin and being, just decaying flesh someday. Really kind of graphic, negative stuff as a way of putting things in perspective. Whatever is in danger of sweeping you away on a torrent of emotions, think about what they really are. Think about them in a future state of decay. Think about your when you look at yourself in the mirror, see a skull looking back at you, right?
So much for eroticism,
Yeah, but it really puts things in perspective, right? If you recognize that bodily pleasures just are, a bunch of nerves and neurons firing. If you think of human relationships and all the things that and all the good things that come with them, if you think of those as decaying states of matter someday, if you look at the great achievements of mankind, whether it's the pyramids or the Roman Colosseum, whether it's the empire you just conquered, this is Marcus Aurelius, the emperor of Rome, right? If you look at all of this grandeur around you, the marble statues that people have built in your name, and then you think of them in 1,000 years or 5,000 years and 10,000 years in a state of decay, look at the state of decay of the ancient of ancient Egypt, like these great civilizations that are now just, you know, dust and monuments that people don't understand anymore. You know, the name is barely readable on the on these marble and stone edifices. You know, if that's your perspective, that whatever grand things we build today are going to be tomorrow's dust, then that puts them in perspective. It keeps you from taking yourself too seriously, keeps you from having too much hubris, keeps you from being swept away in a torrent of emotions, and can keep you grounded. It sounds really negative, but I think the idea is that...
It sounds like the Kobayashi Maru.
And you lost me there. In what way?
Well, and all kidding aside, it's kind of
everything
kind of
is no win scenario. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's the morbidity of thought. It's the same way we desensitize soldiers in order to prepare them for the unimaginable things that they're going to face on the battlefield. The Kobayashi Maru, and again, I've said that tongue in cheek, but you know, all kidding aside, that's the point of the Kobayashi Maru. It's the point of it. Famously from Star Trek 2009, you know, Spock says to Kirk, you know, the point of the exercise is to face death and in a no-win scenario, so that when they're out there and they're faced with the impossible, they'll be able to temper and maintain their response to what's going on and, you know, hopefully... either survive or do their duty to the very end.
Well, I guess that's the strongest connection that I saw to Klingons. Again, I think the problem that I see in thinking about Stoicism in Star Trek is that if for any given race or any given character, they're only partially Stoic. Spock is only partially Stoic. He's got that human emotion side to him. Vulcans are only partially Stoic because they're constantly fighting against the emotions. Klingons are only partially Stoic because they do get swept away in a string of emotions. But what Klingons have going for them is this kind of militaristic discipline, right? They do have the ability to fall in line, be soldiers, to, you know, fight glorious battles, to not be afraid in the face of fear and death and whatnot. And that kind of militaristic aspect, which is part of Marcus Aurelius's Stoicism as Emperor of Rome, who's a conqueror. He has to go out and conquer new lands and bring booty home. And this is what Roman emperors do, right? Even Marcus Aurelius did that. You know, I think Klingons generally have that kind of militarism down more than the Vulcans, more than humans. Klingons have that military discipline in a Stoic way. Or am I reaching a bit? Do you not see that Stoic aspect as strongly as I do in Klingons?
It's funny. We kind of talked about this in the Turbo Lift. You had mentioned the Klingons as possibly being a race that we would want to explore in connection to the idea of Stoicism. And, you know, I kind of, push back against that a little bit. And in your defense, I think when you're thinking of Klingons, at least in my mind, I know Worf is a character that you associate as an individual who represents this kind of Stoic philosophy, this Stoicism in thought and action. And I agree with you very much so that in many ways he does, although we see oftentimes there are instances in which he kind of loses control and he makes that emotional, impulsive choice. He loses touch with, you know, duty and honor, and he goes with his emotion. But I think, as we've mentioned many times, Worf isn't exactly the model Klingon. Klingons, as Guinan reminded Worf, are very different than what Worf is. They are very emotional. They do make emotional decisions. We see that time and again in the original series. We see it certainly in Deep Space Nine, I think, are probably the two series is where we really get to see the Klingons for what they are. And they are very emotional and they are impulsive. So I don't think they're a very good representation. They are militaristic and there is a certain discipline there, but you know, oftentimes we see them very swept up in emotion, and oftentimes that emotion causes them to do really irrational things that I don't think really follow that ideology of Stoicism.
Well, two or three days ago, I would have said, yeah, Worf is like, you know, a good candidate for a Stoic in Star Trek. He's generally doesn't show his emotions, keeps his cards pretty folded, doesn't reveal his inner self a lot. Last night, before I went to bed, I watched the Next Generation episode of The Icarus Factor. And in that episode, we see Worf basically just pissed off. You know, he's got the anniversary of his Age of Ascension. He's being grumpy and pissed off with everyone. And it occurred to me that Worf is actually not a great example of a stoic at all. That, you know, on the outside, he kind of presents a stoic front. He doesn't show himself. He doesn't. He's not boisterous. He's not. He doesn't show pleasure. He doesn't, you know, if something's bothering him, he keeps it to himself a lot of the time. He grumbles and grinds his teeth there behind the captain's chair on the bridge of the Enterprise, but he doesn't reveal it very much. But as I watched that episode, it occurred to me, Worf is actually just in a constant state of being pissed off. That he's not actually, he hasn't achieved that stoic serenity in his inner being in the way that Vulcans aim to. I don't think Worf even aims to. I think he wants to reveal this deeper, you know, more emotional, wave of I would say unhappiness. That's not right. But this wave of dissatisfaction that he carries around with him, he wants to be able to show that more than he's able to. And he's constantly forced to be something that's not terribly authentic. And we see that come to a head when he joins Deep Space Nine, right? He's realized that he's been living a fairly inauthentic life, and he's got to reconcile that with being a Starfleet officer and being a Klingon and having these, you know, inner emotions that he hasn't been able to reveal very much. But I think the Vulcans, by contrast, aim to have this inner serenity, their meditation and their education. You know, Spock only achieves that partially, being half human. He's learned to hide it fairly well. And for him, I think being a Vulcan is more like an act than being, than having inner serenity. But I think someone like Tuvok has become much closer to having a genuine inner Vulcan serenity. You know, he is genuinely able to take whatever comes his way, look at it through the lens of logic, through the lens of this cosmic perspective, the universe unfolding as it should, not letting his emotions get out of check, recognizing that he has them maybe, but keeping them within very, very neutral parameters. And so I think, Tuvok is kind of a great example of a stoic in this genuine inner sense, right? Worf, I think, presents himself as a stoic, but when you drill down below the surface with Worf, there's a torrent of fire in there that never quite reveals itself. And I think with Tuvok, you have to go much, much, much deeper to find that inner core of passion. And Voyager goes there sometimes. We get to see a passionate Tuvok in a couple of instances. But generally, you have to drill a lot deeper to get access to that in Tuvok than you do with Worf.
Yeah, I concur. And that's a great thread, by the way, Tuvok. And I want to touch on that. You know, we talked a little bit about Spock, and I think that's an obvious connection there. You know, in the original series, I think if the original series was saying something to us with the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy trifecta, it's that we should all think like Spock, we should all feel like Bones, we should all act like Kirk. You know, where Spock is in many respects a picture of stoicism, although a flawed one, because he is, after all, half human. Bones is very swept up in passion and emotion. You know, he has, very, very little filter on what he says, how he behaves. And all of that gets tempered in the action of James Tiberius Kirk. Whereas I said Spock was somewhat of a flawed example of stoicism, I think Tuvok really embodies it quite a bit better. And I know that there are fans out there who don't like Tuvok. They think he's too dry. They think, you know, they think that he's abrasive and very single-sided. But I disagree with that, because I think Tuvok best represents what it is to be truly Vulcan. And he doesn't really let go of his emotions. He's always got that same pasty look on his face. He faces every situation, every circumstance with the same tempered reaction. And I think that's a very Vulcan thing. And I think it's stoicism on display.
There's a scene in the Voyager episode Parallax that comes to my mind, Mike. And if you remember in that episode, there's an altercation between B'Elanna Torres and Lieutenant Carey in engineering, resulting in Carey getting a broken nose, if memory serves. And the scene immediately following that is an interesting one. Harry Kim goes to Tuvok in a corridor and says, "Did you hear what happened down in engineering? I heard that the Maquis and the Starfleet, you know, crew members are at each other's throats. There's about to be a scene. They're getting violent." And Tuvok kind of calms Harry Kim down and says, Ensign, let me set you straight. The situation can be described as tense, but nothing more. No one's about to kill each other. No further violence is erupting. And he says, I just don't understand this human need for hyperbole. You know, it's just look at it for what it is. And I think that's an interesting stoic commentary in human nature right there. Humans like to blow things out of proportion. If we're, you know, headed in the positive direction, we're going to blow that way out of proportion and be ecstatic. You know, if we are a little sad or a little depressed or things aren't going our way, it's the end of the world. And it's hyperbole through and through. And Tuvok comes along to Harry Kim and says, look, you know, yes, there was an altercation. Yes, it's a little tense, but that's it. There's nothing else to talk about. There's no catastrophe. So why don't you temper yourself a little bit, Ensign Kim? And I think that's a great commentary, on a stoic commentary in human nature. You know, we do tend to blow things out of proportion. And, you know, part of the job of being a stoic or stoically minded is to temper yourself, bring those emotions back into the middle and look at things for what they are. You know, yes, you know, it is dramatic to think of a dramatic brawl down in engineering where people are at each other's throats. It's, you know, that's a great, would make for a great holodeck narrative, right? Kind of like what you get in the episode, worst case scenario, right?
Yeah. It's funny because as you were talking about that, my mind went to the conversation that took place between Chakotay and Torres right after that. You know, Chakotay kind of paints Tuvok's stoicism, I think, really in an interesting light. He goes to Torres, you know, he's angry with her. He's upset with her because she's put him in a difficult position. And he says, you know, so on one side, I'm facing a Vulcan who wants to court-martial you. And on the other, I'm facing the Maku who are ready to seize the ship over this. You've really turned this into one lousy
it's
day
It's a Kobayashi
me,
Maru kind of day.
It's a Kobayashi Maru kind of day. And
rock in a hard place, and the Scylla in the Charybdis. And then you've got, you know, wait, what were the two things that Chakotay mentions?
The court martial and the Maquis seizing the ship.
Oh yeah, right. Okay.
but what a juxtaposition there between Tuvok's stoicism that, you know, we're going to handle this by the books. We're not going to get emotional about this. She struck a fellow officer. We're going to court martial her. You know, and that's how Chakotay is kind of juxtaposing this situation as opposed to the Maquis, who are very emotional and they're ready to seize the ship. And what does it equal? It equals one lousy day for Chakotay. A little bit fatalist there, but
think how much of daily life is like that. You know, catastrophes seem to pile on sometimes. It's not just one thing that goes wrong. It's one thing that goes wrong, and then five other things go wrong that day or that week or that month, right? And it can feel very much like you're stuck in a rock and a hard place, or between the Scylla and the Charybdis, or between a court martial and a Maquis seizing the ship, right? No, these are no win scenarios. And I think this is a really fascinating discussion because so much of life is like being in a no-win scenario. It seems like you have nowhere to turn. Everything is going wrong and you have to find a way to not panic, not worry about those things, pick yourself up, get out of bed, make a plan, use your reason and carry on with life and do the best you can. And I think that just picking yourself back up aspect is such an important part of being a stoic. You know, it's not a matter of dismissing all of the bad things around you. It's a matter of saying, okay, yes, there's bad stuff happening around me. I don't like it. I'm really stressed out, but darn it, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to get dressed and shave and comb my hair. And I'm going to go out my front door and I'm going to make the world the best I can and make my way. And that's really hard to do. I think, you know, depression can get in the way of that and circumstances can get in the way of that. But I think the heart of Marcus Aurelius's point, at least, is that, you know, we always have our reason to fall back on. And I think this is an incredibly Vulcan point. I'm glad you went in the direction of Vulcans. I thought I was going to be on the right track with Klingons, but really I think we're finding that Vulcans are the better connection here. The Vulcans would say,
yeah, they are definitely Star Trek stuff.
Totally. Vulcans would say, you know, use your reason and figure it out. Don't panic. Don't be depressed. Don't get carried away in this string of emotions. You know, you put your logic hat on and figure out the best thing to do. And humans can always do that. And if you're worried about what's going to happen tomorrow, don't worry about that because you have, not only do you have the same tools you have today, but you have all of today's experience to help you tomorrow to figure it out. And that's a very Vulcan/stoic perspective, I think.
I think it's a very Starfleet perspective as well. I think the best examples of something that Jane, you know, Janeway, the Janeway-ism, Starfleet principles. When we think about Starfleet principles, we think about the Prime Directive. We think about, you know, these values that the Federation, that Starfleet seems to hold dear. They're very stoic in nature. They don't take into consideration a lot of times the individual circumstances or situation. It really is a by the book kind of thing. And oftentimes we see our captains insert their own emotions and their own connections into their actions. But really, when you think about, for instance, the Prime Directive, we're not going to involve ourselves in the affairs of other cultures, other worlds. And that seems like a very stoic kind of point of view, especially when you look at the situations in which we've seen in Star Trek, that yes, sometimes that means warping out before, you know, millions of people die on a planet.
I mean, in general, military organizations, Starfleet or otherwise, depend on a certain state of order. And if you don't have that order, then you run the risk of contingent circumstances dictating your actions, mm-hmm. or your gut reactions dictating your actions. And I think the idea of relying so much on protocol is to prevent these contingent factors and this gut level emotion from swaying your actions, potentially to disastrous consequences in a military. But in Starfleet, it's more like, look, you know, yeah, you might want to help. You might feel sympathy for a certain group of people who are suffering, and that might lead you to break the Prime Directive. And that's why we put a rule there to keep you from breaking the Prime Directive, right? So you don't rely solely on your emotion. It forces you back into using your reason to figure it out. I think, you know, there's this kind of pragmatic middle ground to stoicism that you can rely. So if you're relying too much on your emotions, then you're not using your reason enough, and you're probably going to make bad decisions. If you're relying so much on rules to make your decisions, then you're not being aware. You're not applying those rules to the particular situation at hand with all of its complexities, mm-hmm. and its nuance. And I think that's an important aspect of, you know, what you wouldn't want to do is take stoicism and turn it into something like Kantian philosophy. It's all rule-based, and the rules tell you what to do, right. And you don't have to worry about it because you've got the rules, right? That's not stoicism. I think stoicism is much closer to pragmatism, taking whatever situation is at hand, running it through your filters of reason and logic and tempering your emotions, and only then deciding what to do. Sometimes the rules will be applicable, and sometimes they won't. And sometimes, you know, your emotions will lead you on the right path, and it's a healthy thing to be on. And so other times, those emotions are going to lead you to a destructive path that you shouldn't be on. And you need to be aware of those things in order to make good practical judgments. So I don't think, you know, I think rules are, they're an important tool for helping you temper your emotions and helping you to not rely on destructive emotions, or not relying on your emotions to the point that you're going to make, you know, destructive decisions that lead to bad consequences. But it's not a rule-based philosophy. It's not like Kantian ethics.
Yeah, I concur. Let's talk about Jean-Luc Picard. When we first meet Picard, very stoic. His first interactions. In fact, I find him to be the most stoic of all the captains for the first four seasons. The first three seasons. Extremely stoic, extremely calculated, extremely tempered. But all of that changes after Best of Both Worlds. And I think that's one of the things that makes the episode Family so moving. Such a shocking episode.
It's actually hard for me, partly because I've watched so much Star Trek The Next Generation at this point. It's hard to put myself back in the perspective of what it was like to watch first and second season Picard, not having seen the rest of Star Trek The Next Generation and all of the Next Generation movies. And it's also partly because I was actually fairly young when those first two seasons of The Next Generation were on, and I didn't even watch them then. When The Next Generation launched in 1987, I was 9 years old, and I wasn't clued into Star Trek The Next Generation at that point. I knew about the original series, but I hadn't yet found The Next Generation. I think I discovered The Next Generation in season three or four, like a lot of people did. So for me, when I think about first and second season Picard, I think it's hard for me to really know how he was perceived right off the bat. Like you said, you perceived him as a stoic. And I sort of look at that first season and second season Picard, and I think of him as really kind of hiding who he really is, right? He's put up a wall around himself that beneath that wall, there's the Picard that we see in Family, and there's the Picard that sits down eventually at the end of The Next Generation and plays poker with his crewmates and whatnot. But that's not, you know, the Picard in season one and season two, you know, yes, he has a stoic demeanor, but he's not... I wouldn't just characterize Picard as a stoic in any sort of deep sense. I hope I'm making sense. I sort of feel like I feel like season one and two Picard, he comes across as kind of a jerk sometimes. Mm. Actually, he's not very moved by the things that are around him. In fact, he's kind of annoyed at all of the stuff that comes his way. And I think maybe that's the part that seems even less stoic. He lets things bother him and get to him, and he has these relatively cold reactions. And I don't, you know, when I read something like Marcus Aurelius, who has an affinity for very positive, amicable, you know, interpersonal kind of interactions, that this getting along aspect is a really important part of, it's almost like a Counselor Troy perspective, that all of us getting along is kind of a good thing. And so, you know, whatever give and take it takes interpersonally to make sure we're getting along. If someone offends me, I don't let it bother me very much. And if I offend someone, you know, I want to be proactive about apologizing. And if they don't want to, you know, be reconciled, then I'm not going to let that bother me. I'm just going to, you know, deal with it when they're ready to reconcile. And it's very kind of reconciliatory and very, very positive. And Picard seems largely annoyed in the first couple of seasons to me. And I just don't see stoicism. I think he's put up a wall around himself more than being genuinely, you know, stoic in any inner sense.
I have to disagree with that just a little bit, push back just a little bit. I think that it's this kind of air of stoicism that really attracts Sarek to him as an individual. In fact, Sarek really comments that, you know, he'd make a good Vulcan. And I think there's a wall there, certainly. But I do think that there is an inner discipline, an air of stoicism about him. And I think that's what makes episodes like The Inner Light so moving, because we get to kind of see a little bit deeper beyond the veneer. I guess my point, and I don't think you and I are on different pages here, I think for Picard it was more of a veneer of stoicism, but I do think to some degree he embraces that by and large as a school of thought. And it's only after he makes these really deep connections with the people who are under his command that those pieces, those bricks of that wall, you know, brick by brick, it begins to come down. He has, you know, the situation with the Borg, and, you know, his crew comes after him, and that fundamentally changes him, right? And
that first season, Picard is really kind of worried that if he cracks a smile on the bridge, that his crew is not going to take him seriously and he can't be captain anymore. And, you know, by the end of The Next Generation, Picard has become more comfortable with himself. He's more casual. He can be himself, you know, still with a veneer. You know, he's not going to go, you know, bare his soul to everyone on the bridge or anything like that. But I think he's just becomes more comfortable with himself. And part of this is just aging, I think. As we get older, we do become more comfortable with ourselves. A lot of us do. I think as we age, we can go one of two directions. You can either become more comfortable with yourself, more comfortable with whatever life throws at you. In that sense, you can become more stoic. Or you can become so disaffected by all the things that have happened to you that you aren't able to find that middle ground. You don't feel like you know yourself, or you don't feel you can deal with the things that come your way anymore. And I think I can think of examples of both, but Picard seems to just become more comfortable with his skin. You know, he knows the things he's good at. He knows his faults. He's got more experience under his belt. He's got better relationships. He's let his wall down just a little bit. And now he can be, I would say, a more amicable stoic than he could be in season one and two of TNG.
So what about some other individuals in Star Trek that we can kind of draw some connections to stoicism with?
So the other character that I came up with, Mike, is Odo in Deep Space Nine. Odo has this incredible ability to keep his cool and deal with the things that comes his way. He kind of has the same grumpy demeanor that Worf has, and I like that in the character, because, you know, I myself am like that a lot of the time. The world throws things at me that just frustrate me, and I relate to that a bit. But Odo is, he can deal with a lot of pressure and deal with a lot of stress and keep his cool and find a plan. And he's almost more comfortable with his grumpiness than Worf is. Worf feels like he's got to kind of hide it. And Odo just kind of wears it. He crosses his arms and he's going to stand there and look stern and deal with it. And at the same time, he gets great, great pleasure out of, you know, torturing Quark. And so I guess like the other characters we've talked about, Odo is only partially a stoic, right? He is affected by some things and he can't deal with other situations. In fact, he's remarkably unstoic when it comes to the rest of his people, the founders, other changelings, mm-hmm. right? He's got a weak spot or two that isn't decidedly unstoic. But generally, I think Odo does a pretty good job at keeping his emotions in check and keeping a certain amount of decorum. He likes order, and certainly stoics like order.
Yes.
I mean, this is a theme in Marcus Aurelius, is building order out of chaos. This is what animals do all around them, building their nests or building their beehives and whatnot. And humans do it by building our buildings and building our civilizations and building our starships. But Odo, I think his strong need for order around him is very, very stoic. You know, he's a little too grumpy to be a genuinely happy stoic like Marcus Aurelius. but one of the strongest stoic characters, I think, as I think about individuals in Star Trek.
I agree wholeheartedly. In fact, when we first meet Odo, he's introduced to us as a character who has served on Deep Space Nine going back to the Cardassian occupation. And what he represented really to all sides, and this really is a testament to this brand of stoicism, he really represented justice in an unjust society to all sides. And that really is a credit to his stoicism. But then we get, an episode like The Ascent, that Zachary is the episode where, you know, he and Quark are marooned on Hoth, the ice planet. No, it wasn't Hoth, but it was a cold planet, and they had to take the communications module up the mountain. And, you know, it's very comical in many ways, but we really discover something about Odo, and that is that he's a little less stoic than what we think. He's stoic enough to fight his way up that mountain until he can't go anymore. But I love how he's able to pass that on as a virtue to Quark and really motivate him to see beyond his present circumstances and just survive. He's able to pass that on. But in all of that, we kind of discover something about him at the end of the episode. And it's something that we, I think, suspect all along. And that is that for some strange reason, he's really fond of Quark.
Well, and that's a really interesting, strange episode, because we really see Quark acting more like the stoic.
Yes.
You get this terrible situation, and Quark is the one who's going to take this terrible situation and claw his way up the mountain.
but that is only after, you know, Odo kind of passes that baton to him. It's almost like a philosopher schooling his protege, you know, Quark being Odo's protege, and you know, he kind of passes that baton to him and he says, listen, you've got to basically pull yourself up by the bootstraps and drag this thing to the top and survive. That's what you've got to do. I know you're cold. I know you don't feel like you can do it anymore, but you have to. And that's very stoic, by the way.
And I think of all the change Odo's had to deal with. I mean, if he started out on Deep Space Nine under the Cardassians with their regime and all of the things that regime entails, there's a change of power, and now the Federation's in charge, and he's got to be a security officer for the Federation. You know, this could be world disrupting for Odo, right? But he doesn't let it be. He just deals with the change, deals with the transition. He's going to be a good security officer, or good head of security, under the Cardassians, and he's going to be a good head of security under the Federation. And it's almost like Marcus Aurelius saying, whatever your station life is, just be a good one. And you know, Odo's station life is to be a security officer. And that's who he is and what he does. And yes, he has connotations of justice and whatnot, but fundamentally he creates order out of chaos there on the promenade. And he's going to do that under the Cardassians. He's going to do it under the Federation, and he's going to do it the best he can. And he doesn't let that radical change bother him. And I think this is really, really important for the world today. I mean, think about all the things that are changing. We just had a presidential election. Think how vitriolic this presidential election has been for us here in the United States. you know, what can we do? We can let this ruin our world, or we can pick ourselves back up and be the best versions of ourselves, despite the changes that are happening, despite, you know, whether your side won or your side lost, just do the best you can to build an orderly society. And that's, Odo's really good at that. And so I think that aspect of him, just the ability to deal with change and not let that change disturb him or mess with his mission or who he is or what he thinks he can accomplish in this world. He just picks himself back up and keeps on going no matter what, you know, the universe at large throws at him.
I really think that they need to have a Deep Space Nine, like medical bay kind of, a sick bay kind of moment in our country. Quark is laying there on a bio bed. Odo's laying on the other. Quark says, "You remember back there when I told you I hated you and you told me you hated me?" And Odo says, "Vividly." He says, "I just wanted you to know I meant every word of it." And Odo says, "So did I." And they both have a laugh. And I think that's the kind of healing that we need in our country right now. We don't, the two sides don't agree. But Stoicism says, you know, shake hands and get along.
And I think part of it is not taking yourself too seriously. And this, there's a self-humbling aspect of Marcus Aurelius's writings that is, I think, a really important part of Stoicism. If you take yourself too seriously, you know, I'm the one who has all the virtues and I've got the right answers to everything, then you're going to look down on other people and it's not going to be a good situation. If you knock yourself down a peg and you can laugh at yourself and you can realize your own faults and you can realize your own quirks, you can realize your own prejudices, and you can laugh at those things about yourself and realize that you don't have all the answers, then you're much in a much better position to get along with someone who doesn't see things the same way you do, or people of a different personality, or people who irk you in one way or the other, right? If the goal is reconciliation and constructive interpersonal relationships or constructive political dialogue, you know, you can come up with 10 other things: constructive home life, constructive civic life, constructive judicial system, constructive politics, whatever. If that's the goal, then part of that is self-humility and realizing that, at the end of the day, you know, I don't like you and you don't like me, but I can laugh at myself and I'm not right, and you should laugh at yourself and you're not right all the time either. And together we can sit down and, you know, get along and figure out what the right thing to do is. And I think that knocking yourself down a peg aspect of Stoicism, seeing yourself as, if you're in a position of superiority, or if you're in a position of authority, or in a position of power, you're there largely by circumstance. You got lucky. You have some strengths. You got a lot of weaknesses. Other people help hold you up, and you don't have all the right answers. And you're going to die someday. So, you know, that cosmic perspective that, you know, this short little human lifetime that we get, no matter what I achieve in this life, is just going to be a footnote in history someday if I'm lucky. That should put things in perspective for a lot of us. But, you know, so many of us get caught up in this sort of self-inflated view. We don't see our limitations, and we think we've got all the right answers, and we don't have that sense of humility. And think how many of the problems in the world could be solved if everyone just had a bit more humility and everyone took that more cosmic perspective of themselves. I've got some intuitions about the right thing to do, but I may not have all the answers, and I'm going to die someday anyway. So if you like my idea and we think we can do something good with it, that's great. If not, don't hate me and I don't hate you. That would just be a much better world than what we've seen here in the last few months and mankind, or sentient beings at their worst. So I think the Stoic perspective can be really useful. I think it's a little negative in a way. It can hold you back and keep you from striving and striving and striving. And I think where it conflicts a little bit with the Star Trek worldview, I think Stoicism probably errs a little bit too much on the side of just be happy and content where you are, do the best you can in your own little corner of the world. I think Star Trek tries to think a little bit more, pardon the pun, on a galactic scale.
Yes.
That you should keep trying to push yourself forward. And if that means if you're a slave now, then push yourself a little harder and maybe you won't be a slave anymore. If you're lower class right now, socioeconomically, then work a little harder and you will be able to just kind of rise to the next level. If you have an idea for what you want to do in life, work a little harder at it and keep going. And Stoicism does have that sense of being able to, construct something and use your reason and solve things. But it also has this kind of negative sense of just be kind of content where you're at and do your best in your own little corner of the universe. And I think Star Trek is much more forward looking than that in general, that that it's not enough to be content where you're at and make a difference where you're at. You want to try to go out into the galaxy and forge a better life for all of us on a galactic scale. So I don't think the central missions of Stoicism and the central mission of the Star Trek worldview match up all that well. But Stoicism is just such a practical tool for dealing with whatever life throws at you. I find it very, very valuable. Every time I find myself, you know, with my emotions out of check or in difficult situations, I can open up a little Marcus Aurelius and go, oh yeah, this is a temporary situation. It's going to get better. And if not, I'm going to be dead in 50 years anyway, and it won't matter. And I think that that is such a useful tool for putting things in perspective. And I think we as humans are just so bad at putting things in perspective. We get caught up in our own worldviews and our own situations and our own struggles. We forget to calm down and say, wait a minute, does this really matter to the extent that I think it does?
Sure. Because in life, Zachary, it may not be a Romulan warbird. I mean, Tom Locke may not be dropping his cloak on your port bow, but you oftentimes find that difficult situations come your way and there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, Captain Picard cannot control that Romulan warbird and where it's going to decloak and what it's, you know, what Tomalak's going to do.
It's a Tomalak kind of day.
It's a Tomalak kind of day. And so you simply have to sometimes take what you've got and do the best you can with it. And I think that's, again, Stoicism at its finest. It's a very Star Trek thing, but I think you're exactly right. Just because I'm a junior grade lieutenant wearing a blue uniform, it doesn't mean that I can't have four pips on my collar and be a captain someday. And I think that's a great message. And I think it's an important message.
So I think there's a flip side to that. If you're that junior grade lieutenant with a blue uniform on and two pips on your collar, kind of like Captain Picard in that episode Tapestry, where he lives this alternate life and he's a lieutenant now, he's not the captain anymore, right? If you are that individual and you've envisioned yourself as a captain, you see potential for yourself, you envision that red uniform, that crimson uniform with the four pips on your collar commanding the flagship of the Federation, and that's how you see yourself, even though you're a junior grade lieutenant with a blue uniform. Then you can set yourself up for disappointment, right? You can let the fact that you haven't achieved that eat away at you and eat away at your motivation to keep picking yourself back up, doing the best you can. And I think this is, again, where Stoicism comes into play. The flip side is, yeah, you may not actually achieve your dreams, but that's not a reason to be depressed and be lazy and stay in bed all day, right? You need to get up, put that blue uniform on, put your pips on, put that communicator pin on, polish your boots, walk out into the corridor and do the best you can. Be the best lieutenant you can. You might not achieve captain, but you might make, full commander, right? You might become first officer on a starship, you know? And I think there's a self-defeating aspect of having dreams and ambitions, right? You can be so obsessed with those that if life takes you any other path, you can feel defeated. You can feel depressed. And Stoicism would say, you got to get that in check, right? Yeah. You've got dreams that haven't come to fruition. So does everyone. Welcome to the club. You know, get your butt out of bed and go do the best you can wherever you are in life and try to make, you know, yourself and the world a little better. And I think there's a day-to-day aspect of that. Yes, there's these long-term dreams and ambitions. I've got them. You've got them. You know, Lieutenant Picard had them in the blue uniform. But that doesn't stop you from doing the best you can, you know, right there in the moment every day and getting out of bed and just trying a little harder. And I think it's that tenacity of just getting up, moving forward, one foot in front of the other. You know, if you're Quark clawing your way up the mountain when you're thirsty and you're tired and you just, you know, you want to collapse and you can't let yourself, that, you know, just focusing on the next footstep in front of you is a very, very Stoic attitude in when faced with difficulties or with dreams that haven't come to fruition.
And then you can have a day like Chakotay. I mean, you're a Starfleet dropout, you're a defector from the Federation, you've joined the Maquis, and then one day you get sucked into the Delta Quadrant, and next thing you know, you're first officer on a Starfleet ship. I mean, sometimes, my point, all kidding aside, my point is, sometimes circumstances change. And by the way, I think early on, I think Chakotay was somewhat of a Stoic character, but you know, the writing for his character took a different direction. I don't think he really fits the bill, but you know, in many respects, I think Chakotay has some earmarks of Stoicism.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about the changes that the turns on a dime that can happen in the Star Trek universe, right? You mentioned when Chakotay was on the run as part of the Maquis. Next thing you know, flip of a switch, and he's first officer on a Federation starship, right? You know, Captain Picard, he's captain of the Federation flagship. But, you know, along comes Star Trek Generations, and before you know it, the Enterprise D crashes on a planet. There's no more Enterprise D anymore, right? You know, things can turn on a dime in life, and you can't let that fact keep you from, you know, pushing forward the next day. You know, there will be whatever the state of affairs is, it's only temporary, and there will be a change. It could be for the better, it could be worse. If it's worse today, it'll probably be better tomorrow. If it's better today, it'll probably be worse tomorrow. That's just the ebb and flow of life, and you can't get so attached. And I think this, if there's a fundamental nugget of stoicism, it's don't get attached to things. Everything is temporary. Everything is fleeting. Today's pleasure is going to be pain tomorrow. Today's pain will probably be lesser tomorrow. You know, you know, things will turn on a dime. Maybe luck will come your way. Maybe it won't, but you can't be pulled in the extremes. You have to recognize it for what it is. It's just a temporary situation. And that long-term temporal perspective on things, I think, is an important part of stoicism. And, you know, we most of us can't see past our noses, right? You know, I can't see past what's happening this afternoon, much less happening in a week or a month or 10 years or 50 years. And that longer term perspective is what allows you to take the crisis of today and not make it the catastrophe that sometimes we do.
And that's why Sir Ox said, make the best use of what's in your power and take the rest as it happens. That was actually Epictetus.
That might have been actually written down at the time of the first Vulcan-human encounter.
Maybe Epictetus had pointed ears and green blood.
Maybe he was the first to visit Earth.
He could have been.
Maybe it wasn't T'Pol's ancestor after all.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Stoicism in Star Trek, but this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. To the journey!
Some races are like Talaxians. We really don't know how long they've kind of been around.
Char, what? I just had a great idea. I need to calm myself down. I need some
Breathe.
Ice. I need
Breathe.
Some ice.
Okay. Rest your head.
Okay.
Easy. In
All right.
And out.
Warp 5.
What's your favorite episode of Enterprise?
I usually say Strange New World. The first part of Strange New World just reminds me so much of being a kid and growing up in southeastern Oklahoma in the mountains and the woods. And I just imagine what it would be like to go camping on an alien planet.
Meta Treks.
After 150 years of sitting around in the mud, that's got to be one relaxed symbiote.
But there again, it shows that, at least for the symbiote on Trill, that there's life beyond the mud.
Life beyond the mud.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for our listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way that you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. So, Zachary, when you're not trying to figure out how Marcus Aurelius applies to cheating on the Kobayashi Maru, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group on Facebook if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not looking for Vulcaneers on busts of ancient Stoic philosophers, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, I'm most active on Facebook, certainly around the Babel Conference. When I'm not trying to get green blood samples, I can also be found on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701, and on Instagram, cmichael1701. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, executive producer Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. We'd also like to give a special shout-out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5, and Kay Shaw. She's also on Twitter at ChocoWeeble. We want to thank them for continuing to make Metatrex possible, and we appreciate your contributions to the network. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
Sounds like Worf's bedtime reading, sitting here reading a little Marcus Aurelius before he goes to bed. You haven't read Marcus Aurelius until you read it in the original Klingon.
Beautiful. And I was thinking, since we were talking about Stoicism, we would not have jokes tonight, but apparently we have jokes.
Oh, no, yeah.